Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. Now, I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you have any question or comment, we invite your calls at 464-8295 or at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But hold your calls for at least half an hour because we have a guest I've been trying to get on for some time since I first heard about him. He had worked for our government apparently on sort of black operations for some time. And then, of course, he was made and given orders by President George Bush, and he couldn't in good conscience carry out those orders, so he left the organization, and of course he was subsequently tracked down and put in prison. We've talked to his wife in the past, who has a fascinating story to tell as well, but now we have with us Chip Tatum. And Chip, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Doctor, for having me.
Well, why don't you just start out telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, your military background, and then how you got involved with these intelligence, so-called intelligence organizations for our government.
Sure. As a young recruit back in 1970, I was moved into the area of air traffic control and the top 10% of our class out of Keesler Air Force Base. I attended jump school at Fort Benning, Georgia, the Army jump school. And we were made into what's called combat controllers. I was subsequently sent to Oklahoma, Tinker Air Force Base, to the 3rd Mobile Communications Group, and from there I was sent TDY to NKP, Thailand. At NKP, I was assigned to a unit known as Task Force Alpha. Task Force Alpha was the prime intelligence facility for that area of operations in Southeast Asia. While I was there, I was at assigned to a team that is known as Team Red Rock. Team Red Rock was given the mission by Washington to go into Cambodia. We dressed as sappers, jumped into the Phnom Penh airport, left authentic North Vietnamese sappers dead on the ground with weaponry, blew up the airport and exited the area of operations. Little did we know that the president's orders were Team Red Rock would not exit the area. And so plans were made for the assassination of Team Red Rock by Montagnards, which are North Vietnam, or which are Vietnamese mountain men trained by special forces.
Now, why didn't they want your unit to leave? Was it simply because you would be an embarrassment if you ever came back?
Not only an embarrassment. The Cambodians were our allies, and if other allies had heard that this particular mission was done by American soldiers, they would never trust the Americans, nor would they trust an allied contract. So it was imperative as far as Nixon felt, and Nixon was very nervous about everything, from what my handler told me when I was later recruited. He couldn't live with the fact that one of us may come forward and talk.
Well, now, basically, of course, Richard Nixon at that time was lying to the American people, saying we weren't in Cambodia, and insisted before Congress and to everybody else that there were no American troops in Cambodia. And, of course, he wasn't telling the truth. All right. Now, then, how did you your unit get out, or did your unit get out?
Team Red Rock originally started as 13 men. A mixture of Navy SEALs, myself, Air Force, two CIA officers, and the rest were Green Beret. We were captured, and three of us came out of captivity. However, one was critically wounded and ended up dying from the wounds. When we were liberated, we were actually liberated by a routine Marine patrol that came into the encampment, got in a firefight, not knowing we were there, and they won. Had they lost, I wouldn't be here today.
All right, fine. So you must have been then brought over fairly close to the border. Was that what happened?
Yeah, we were brought, we were actually being held within four miles of the South Vietnamese-Cambodian border on the Cambodian side. The North Vietnamese were able to go over there in an R&R and recoup themselves because we weren't allowed officially to cross the border to go after them. South Vietnam.
Okay, so you came back then, and of course, did they then recruit you back into some other government unit in the hope of keeping you silent?
Well, actually, I was unconscious when we were following the liberation, and I had my brain had been swollen from the head wounds that I'd received. I was shot in the leg, in the butt, and in the head. I was taken to Clark Air Force Base, and while I was held at Clark Air Force Base, when I came to, the man that briefed us initially for the operation, the man we called Mr. Peepers, who was out of Saigon with the agency, ended up coming out to Clark Air Force Base to debrief me. This man, Mr. Peepers, then gave me the choice to stay with the military or to enjoin him in the Central Intelligence Agency, and his name was Bill Colby.
I see.
My code name at that time was given to me as Pegasus.
So you went ahead then and joined the CIA?
That's correct.
Okay, fine. So then you worked fairly closely with Mr. Colby for a time?
Mr. Colby was my handler. Through the time he left the CIA, he maintained me simply because of the sensitivity of the missions that we'd done. I had survived, but Nixon's decision was I always had to, and the other survivor had to be held close under wing, and so Mr. Colby was our handler, myself and the first sergeant that survived, Chuck.
All right, fine. So then what happened?
I've traveled throughout Southeast Asia, went into Asia. I traveled into Italy on assignment into Soviet bloc countries, and Mr. Colby, because had subsequently become the director of the CIA, and because that's a political position and a new president came in, Mr. Colby left, and the new president brought in a new director of the CIA who would be my handler, and his name was George Bush.
I see.
I worked for George Bush for a year until at Colby's bequest I went ahead and retired, left active government service, and went to Gunnison, retired into Colorado, Gunnison, Colorado. In 1980, however, two men from the government visited me at my little sub shop that we had in Gunnison, Colorado, and let me know that I was being involuntarily reactivated. I was then sent to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and Fort Rucker, Alabama. We were forming a new aviation group. The people out there today know it as the Black Helicopters, which is Task Force 160. Task Force 160, one of the units out of Task Force 160, the Little Bird unit, was actually controlled by the National Security Council. And we found that out when we were visited. There was a crash of one of the commanders of the Little Birds when Washington sent a crash investigator out. The crash investigator, who told us his name was Jake, actually Oliver North.
I see. So you came in contact with a lot of very interesting people then. What year was that?
That was in 1983.
All right.
In 1985, with the Bolin Act coming out, which caused the restrictions of U.S. Involvement in the Nicaraguan Revolution, when the Bolin Act came out, we decided that since we can only provide humanitarian support, that they would take some of the pilots from the CIA and NSC-controlled Task Force 160, place them in medevac aircraft, and we would pose as medevac aircraft flying in and out of Honduras and Nicaragua. That was in 1985. I was placed into that area of operation.
And what were you doing? Were you actually supplying the Contras?
Sure. We were actually flying the Contras, actually flying medical supplies. We were serving three masters because we had to infiltrate actual medevac units that were on assignment in there. We were serving the United States Army. We were also serving Mill Group, which was CIA out of the embassy in Tegucigalpa. And the third group of missions and the primary group that we supported was the NSC, and our handler was Oliver North.
All right, fine. Now, other than simply taking military supplies in, and of course this was being done against in violation of the law, but they weren't really concerned about the law. They felt that they had to help the Contras. But where did the drugs begin to come into this?
Well, on February 26th, I picked up two pilots and flew them into a Contra camp named El Paraiso.
Now, what were you flying? Were you flying,
a Huey at the time.
All right.
Our Blackhawks were grounded because we had stabilator problems. That's the rear elevator on the Blackhawk.
All right.
So they were grounded, so we were flying Hueys at the time. I took the two pilots on the flight plan are a man named Cooper and a man named Sawyer, who in 1986 would end up crashing and begin the investigations into the arms transactions in that area. When we picked them up out of El Paraiso to take them to San Lorenzo, a air base in Honduras, we picked up two coolers marked medical supplies. Or no, these two coolers were marked vaccine. When we landed, I landed a little hard. It bounced around a little on the inside. The two pilots exited to go get on the aircraft that was waiting to take them. And we had instructions that the vaccine was to be given to a particular C-130 bound for Panama. The seal on the coolers had popped open, had broken. I looked in it, and there were over 100 bags of cocaine in that particular cooler. I decided I needed to do something, so I called my handlers. I called Mr. Rodriguez, who was actually Major Rodriguez, who was actually Felix Rodriguez in Honduras. He was in La Ceiba at a safe house. I advised him what I found, and he assured me that it was simply fruits of the war, that the Sandinistas were making and trafficking cocaine to help their efforts. I then called Mr. North through Washington Switch and advised him what I found, and he advised me the same thing. Subsequently, I had spoken to Mr. Gregg, who was assistant national security advisor to the vice president, who was Vice President Bush at the time, and he assured me the same thing, fruits of the war. However, through my term in Honduras, which was about a four-month period, I carried 8 tons of fruits of the war.
I see. So it was well known in Washington, D.C. that drugs were being smuggled out of one area going into Panama, presumably to be brought back into the United States, or do we know what happened to the drugs?
Well, I know that on the back of each flight plan after the February 26th find, I decided to start writing what we were carrying and who we were carrying and what was going on. So on the back of all my flight plans are extemporaneous notes. I would land back at our base operations at Pomerola Air Base in Honduras, which Pomerola is the Honduran equivalent of our Air Force Academy here. I would land, I would make the notes on the back. Those notes and those flight plans maintained in the hands of the Honduran government until 1995, when I retrieved certified copies of those. The original copies are still with a high-placed Honduran government official. He's willing to bring those forward for evidence at any time that the United States decides to prosecute, and Capitol Hill is quite aware of that.
I'm sure, though, that the last thing they want is for the American public to realize that our government is the largest single drug smuggler in the world.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Because what better way to corrupt our youth, to demoralize our blacks, to put our blacks in jail, than to offer them cheap drugs? And, of course, they're being brought into America, and many of the drug users are dying. But, of course, to the people in key positions, these lives are really not very important. They're the sort of people with weaknesses, and we might be better off without them. That would almost seem to be the attitude. Did you ever hear that attitude expressed by any of the people you were in contact with?
On April 10th, I landed in a little airport called San Lorenzo. An agent for the CIA exited his C-123 aircraft and came up to me. He had been working for the CIA for many years. I had met him and spoken with him about 2 weeks prior in a meeting in Panama. He came over to me and I asked him, I said, Barry, his name was Barry Seal, I said, what's going on with all this drugs? Where is it really going? And he told me it was going to the United States. It was going to various locations. And he gave me what I call a boss hog list, because he gave me a list of all the government officials around the world who knew who were participating in some way in this drug trafficking and movement and manufacturing. It wasn't just trafficking. It was actually manufactured in these Contra camps. He gave me the list, and he told me that this particular group of drugs, which was about 10 coolers, 10 coolers was about 1,000 kilos, because there was about a little over 100 kilos in each cooler. That particular batch was bound for Southern California to make crack.
Well, now, didn't you realize that what you were doing was going to eventually come back on you one way or the other, because they can't allow people with this sort of knowledge to be out, walking the streets? We know what happened to Barry Seal after making a deal with the government to sort of excuse him for the fact that he was manipulating things on the side. He was put in a situation where he exposed some of the major drug czars in Central America, and they, of course, were identified. And then, instead of giving him anonymity, put him in the witness protection program, they left him right out there, and he was simply gunned down as he was going to his place he was assigned for, public service.
Well, that's true. He was gunned down, but he was gunned down at George Bush's orders, not at anyone else's orders.
All right, and of course, everybody sort of wondered who gave the orders. Certainly, he was set up to be killed. There's no question at all. Why do you say George Bush gave those orders?
Because in one of the camps, Oliver North was in, and on one of the back of the flight plans that I have, on March 30th.
Of what year now are we talking about?
1985.
Right.
Barry Seal was killed in, January or February of 86. But on March 30th of 1985, we landed in Santa Ana and met with Enrique Bermudez, who was a Contra commander, and some other Contra leaders. We meaning myself, Mr. Oliver North, Felix Rodriguez, General Alvarez, who was the Honduran chief of staff, and a man named Amir Amnir, who was a Mossad agent. These were people on the flight plan. Mr. North stated the following to the other passengers: one more year of this and we'll all retire. And he made a remark concerning Barry Seal and Governor Clinton. If we can keep those Arkansas Hicks in line, that is referring to the loss of monies determined in the meeting a week prior in Costa Rica.
Well, now, where does Mossad fit into this?
The primary contact for all of the pickup of the drugs that were placed on Air Force C-130s and flown out of Honduras was a man named Mike Harari. He was actually codenamed Dr. Harari. His codename was Cobra, but Dr. Harari was the man who would pick up these coolers marked medical supplies or medical vaccine from our Air Force C-130s. Mike Harari had been assigned to General Noriega years before, just following the death of Noriega's brother. And Mike Harari had worked in as a confidant to General Noriega and was his actual contact person. And a senior Mossad agent, by the way.
All right, fine. Now, did you actually hear North say these things?
Yes, I stood, I listened. I was standing by a vat of leaves that had just been crushed, and North said, they were talking. What about what Mr. North was referring to? And let me read it right out of the Chronicles.
Now, what are these? Is this your publication or what?
That's correct. In 1995, as I stated, I got certified copies of these, and I was arrested within 2 weeks by the FBI. I was told to give up the documents that I had, or I would face treason charges. I thought about it for a couple weeks, and I called the Secret Service and told them to come back and see me. I was being held at Inglewood Federal Holding Facility in Inglewood, Colorado, in Denver, Colorado. I told them to come over. I had the documents for them. They came over, and I had published them in a book that I called the Tatum Chronicles. I gave a copy of it to them, and I let them know that copies went and flooded Capitol Hill also. There's your documents, boys. I wanted to make sure they weren't bound for the shredder.
All right, fine. Of course, the other thing is, had you given them up, you might be very dead at the present time.
That's true.
And now, is this document available? Is this book available?
This is. It's. We have it available now at a toll-free number. It's at 1-800-201-7892, extension 58. If you call that number, we have to charge for the book. Otherwise, it's free on our website online. They can download all they want. I would rather give everyone these documents free, but it does cost us to...
All right, fine. Give me the telephone number again.
That's 1-800-201-7892.
And how? And extension 58. And then what about the website?
The website is www.wild-life.com. All small case.
All right, fine. So that's www.wild-life.com. And you can pick up much of this material up there on the website and pull it down. And I really believe Chip is getting this out as far as he can, because if he that makes him really probably less at risk, because more people will be more suspicious should something befall him, an accident like has happened to so many other people who've been involved in these illegal government activities. Now, of course, it wasn't very long after that when Oliver North was actually testifying before Congress on the Iran-Contra hearings.
That's correct. He testified before Congress. However, the scope of the investigation and the scope of the testimony did not include, and that was explicit instructions to the special prosecutor and the investigators, it did not include the movement of drugs or the trafficking of drugs. It was restricted to movement of monies and the movement of arms between certain countries.
In other words, the last thing they wanted was when they had Oliver North there sitting in his lieutenant colonel's uniform with all those medals on him to have somebody ask him about drug smuggling.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And I happen to know, just as an off aside, why one of my friends went up to Oliver North at one of the Republican meetings we were going to, because Oliver North is a very frequent and very popular speaker at Republican meetings, and my friend sort of got past those two big burly bodyguards that were always with him, and I never could figure out how a Marine Corps lieutenant colonel would have enough money for two big burly bodyguards to accompany him every place. But my friend said, you know, why don't you and Colonel Greitz get together? You know, you're both patriots. And North looked at him and said, I never had anything to do with drugs. My friend made some remark about this gentleman, Richard Armitage, who Bo Greitz had said that Richard Armitage was one of the people in the White House primarily involved in the drug trafficking. And North said, well, he was my closest friend. And, you know, just things that just sort of didn't quite ring true. And that was at that point I said, you know, maybe some of these stories we're hearing really do have a foundation to them, that Oliver North really did know about the drug smuggling and that was going on with the full knowledge of the people in the White House.
Lieutenant Colonel North really did know about it and was very, very involved in it. And as a matter of fact, being the hard-charging Marine that he was very good at it. By using a man named Ramon Navarro, who was the contact between the Medellin cartel and the Olympic cartel. That's what I call this group of men, because of the enormity with which they deal and the items that they deal in. He was the contact between the Medellins and the Contras, and was actually their the mainstay that would see to the paste being brought in, streamlining the process. When there wasn't enough paste, he would see to it that leaves were flown up from Chile.
So, now, is he making any personal profit on this?
I imagine he was. However, he was assassinated just before he was to testify in the Noriega trial.
No, I'm sorry. I was speaking of Oliver North.
Oh, well, I don't know. I can't say that he ever received a dime, but his statement saying that one more year of this and we can all retire, I don't think he was talking about from the government service.
I see. Well, we do know that General Secord apparently, was it General Secord, or there was somebody who was involved with all of these things that was making a large personal profit? I think that was General Secord, wasn't that?
It was General Secord, and General Secord heard me speaking on a radio station in Fort Walton Beach and has come out and stated that he has never trafficked in cocaine, and he would challenge me on the air, so I'm looking forward to that.
Well, now, was he involved in this, to your knowledge?
The only involvement I know that was ever told to me was by Barry Seal, so that's secondhand. I don't have any direct knowledge that he was.
Okay, fine.
But it was given to me. His name was given on that list that's in the Tatum Chronicles as one of the Boss Hogs.
Okay, fine. So this is really an amazing story, and you're going all over America giving this. I heard your tapes on the Peter Ford Show, which, you know, were just devastating. What sort of response are you getting as you tell the story?
Well, there are a lot of people out there who just can't believe that the government would be involved in this. There are others who can't believe that Oliver North, a true Marine, can be involved in this. I know on one show someone called in and said, how can you say this about a true American hero? Oliver North is an American hero and, you know, he has done nothing wrong. Well, you know, because a person was a hero 20 years ago doesn't mean he hasn't done anything wrong. And my feeling is that Oliver North was a hero. He was a hero in Vietnam. Over 20 years ago, he was a hero. So he should be able to hang those medals that he earned in his prison cell.
Okay, fine. Now, subsequently, then, you were involved with the flying these drugs back and forth. And after the mid-1980s, did you continue working for the agency?
In 1986, we decided that working for the military and the agency was just too conflicting. It was illegal, for one thing. So I moved out of the militarily restrictive environment and moved directly into working for the NSC under the anti-terrorist group called the OSGs, which is Operational Subgroups. They were actually authorized through the National Security Decision Directives in the early Reagan administration that authorized the Crisis Pre-Planning Group and the Terrorist Incident Working Groups. They then took a number of officers out of the Central Intelligence Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, and some of the major law enforcement and investigative agencies, and placed them in this international group, and that's where I remained until 1992.
All right, fine. So then what, you just taking trips around the world? Were you, you know, organized into any sort of hit teams? What were they doing?
We actually had three groups. One was the Anti-Drug Task Force that was run by Vice President Bush, and a lot of people read about that in earlier years. The other was the Anti-Terrorism Task Force, which actually worked in moving armament around the world and selling arms. And the third was the neutralization teams, which I was on.
Now, what were the neutralization teams doing? What is a neutralization team's, what's the object?
A neutralization is really an alignment. It's like you would take a car, put it in neutral, and move it to where you want it. If we had world financiers or politicians or citizens around the world that weren't aligned with what our goals were, or what our boss's goals were, then it was our job to neutralize those people. We could neutralize them by any of three means that we had available. We could simply intimidate them. We could go a little farther and coerce them into alignment, or we could terminate them.
All right, fine. So, of course, the government has been told, there are restrictions on the CIA after it came out, I believe at the Church Committee, that the government was assassinating people throughout the world and had been involved in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba and of Diem and Nu in Southeast Asia. And there were many, a great deal of testimony that we were considering assassinating Fidel Castro. And so directives were put out and laws were passed that the CIA was no longer to have assassination teams, because that just wasn't right. We weren't supposed to be going around killing people. But you're suggesting that despite the fact that those laws are in the books, our government has continued having assassination teams?
The law was written that without a finding, that can't happen. So now what we have is we have a finding by the National Security Council that allows that, yes.
What? How do you mean by a finding? And before you answer that, we're going to have to take our first break for the program. And Chip has been telling us about his amazing, amazing experiences. And so finally he drops out of the military, and now he's working specifically for the CIA. So what happened at that point?
Well, at that point, we weren't working for the CIA.
Oh, you weren't? Okay.
We were paid by the CIAs. We were working directly for the OSGs, which places us in civilian positions and in under the control of international entities. So at that point, even though we required national decision directives and findings, we We weren't violating U.S. law simply because we weren't working for the agency.
I see. So, in other words, it was illegal for the CIA to terminate, but not necessarily for the National Security Council.
That's correct.
Isn't that convenient?
If there's a finding that it has to do with national security. And the termination was always written as being determined by the officer assigned with the job. We were authorized to exceed existing FTMs, field training manuals, and regulations. And if loss of life occurred, is the way that the authorizations always were wrote, you would not be prosecuted.
All right, fine. So how long did you work for that unit?
I worked for them for 6 years.
All right. And then something happened that caused you finally to say, I'm not going to continue doing this.
On several occasions, I was asked to perform services against U.S. citizens, and I wouldn't have anything to do with that. Finally, a presidential candidate was the target given to us by Mr. Bush, and then President Bush, there was no way. I simply said, no, we're not going to do this. I'm out of here. I walked away. I told my handler at the time I was done. I gave them a copy of a tape that we had made. And the tape actually consisted of many documents. Some of them are in the Tatum Chronicles. They were, you know, working for the agency. We had the best equipment in the world available to us, the most high-tech that there is. So we had audios, videos, surveillance of anything and everything we had done in the past just to cover our backsides, because we knew what we were doing could catch up to us someday, and we needed this insurance policy. We gave him a copy of the tape. We placed it in six places around the world, and the eight of us that left said, if any of us die, if you have put harm to any of us or this presidential candidate, we'll see that they're released.
Well, now, of course, who you were talking about was Ross Perot. And
that's
Ross
correct.
Perot, during the campaign in 1992, came out and said that the Republicans were out to kill him, out to embarrass him. And everybody said, this paranoid little guy, you know. How did he find out that the orders had been put out to neutralize him?
Early January, when I was given the test to neutralize him, I walked away, I caused a friend who was an active officer in Tampa, Florida, to go to Mr. Perot, let him know while he was at Saddlebrook in Tampa what was going on and what was planned, and let him make a logical decision from there.
And was that why he dropped out of the campaign for a time?
I think that's why he dropped out, yes. I haven't talked to him about it.
Okay, fine. And of course, I remember Rush Limbaugh would, put on these caricatures of Ross Perot. Of course, he was Rush Limbaugh being an extension of the Republican Party. He's part of the Republican establishment. And, of course, he would then ridicule Mr. Perot because he thought somebody was trying to do him in, and he would have these little cardboard caricatures of Ross Perot hiding behind trees, waiting for somebody to come to try to kill him. And then Rush would laugh, and the audience would laugh, and the people in the television audience would laugh. But, of course, there was an element of truth to what Ross Perot was saying.
There was an element of very deadly truth, and had Mr. Limbaugh ever had an inkling or a percentage of what we do done to him, he wouldn't go on the radio again.
Well, of course, Mr. Limbaugh serves a very useful purpose as far as thought control in America. And he's a master entertainer, but that's what he is. He also, simply like the Pied Piper of Hamlet, has a very efficient means of leading people away from the truth. But, I love to listen to him, and he's always entertaining, and he certainly can argue points very effectively. The trouble is, 90% of the time, he's absolutely right on. It's that other 10% of the time where he does the great harm to the survival of our republic. So then what happened? Now, you've walked away from the agency, and a number of people in your unit just quit at that point?
That's correct. Eight of us walked away at that point. Many of us are in hiding right now. Two others are still in prison. I was chased and finally put in prison. I was tempted with the treason charge that was placed in front of me, and I basically told them, let's dance, they're not getting the stuff, because to give it up would be terminal for me and my family. I was charged with treason. Later that was dropped, and I was ended up being charged with conspiring to make a false statement to the government. They had to provide, under the conspiracy laws, they had to provide one viable witness And the man who showed up was a Marine Lieutenant Colonel who happened to be one of the leaders in the Ollie North campaign. He showed up to testify against me, stating that I conspired with him to make a false statement to the government over some contracts.
I see. And what happened with that?
Well, my wife was also charged in that. I didn't have a hard time with walking in and pleading to it, just in agreement with North and the boys that you can't have these tapes, but I will plead to a felony so that I'm not a viable witness against you men. I'm not a credible witness at that point. But then they charged my wife. That's when I decided, okay, you know, you're going after a civilian here, and I don't buy that. So at that point, I didn't plead out. I went to trial. When I decided to go to trial, they seized all of our assets, including every piece of furniture we had and all of our clothes. They put them in a Ryder van. The FBI put them in a Ryder van and wouldn't give us anything, provided my wife the clothes on her back, her car, and $30.
Now, basically, then, what they do is they seize everything you have so you can't defend yourself. So you can't get a lawyer.
Then they assign the defender to you.
Right.
Uh-huh. Out of 80 witnesses that I had given my federal public defender at that point to call in our defense, not one was called. When the prosecution put on their case, our defense team stood up and said, Your Honor, the defense rests.
Well, couldn't you at that point approach the judge and say, this is rigged?
No. Not, you can't approach the judge as long as you're represented by...
Why didn't you fire your representative then? It was obviously...
Once you go past Bureau Dwyer, which is the choosing of the jury, you can't fire your... That's federal rules of procedure. Fire your attorney.
So then what happened at the trial?
So you're stuck. You go into the next phase, which is the sentencing phase. I think all of you saw the sentencing phase as it went forward. With McVeigh, you saw a little bit of the federal trial. No matter how unhappy you are with your attorney, once you go into the trial begins, you can't fire him. So you're stuck.
Well, can't you speak in your own behalf?
Yes, at your sentencing, you're allowed to speak in your own behalf, and at that time, the judge will listen to you. And at that time, we explained to the judge what happened, and the judge said, "Fine, I'm going to sentence you to 2 years."
I see. And so then...
Take it up with the appellate court.
And so you... lots of luck because we've got all your money and you can't hire a lawyer.
Sure.
So then what happened? We know that you were in jail for a time. How long were you in prison?
2 years.
Okay, fine. And then when you got out, did they tell you just to be quiet? Or?
Yes. After I got out, about 2 weeks after I got out, because I was in prison for that amount of time. Actually, on that sentence, I was only in prison for 6 months. On a two-year term. I had been held without bond for a year and a half, and the judge decided, since I had some things to say to him in the courtroom that weren't very nice, that I was not to get credit for any time served. So although I had been in for a year and a half at that point, none of that counted toward the two-year sentence. So I'd been in 6 months, and I had made some noise inside. I was very unhappy with being there. I was doing radio shows from inside the prison, and I decided we had this wonderful, I didn't decide, myself and my friends decided we had this wonderful insurance policy, so I started going around to different groups in prison. And if people don't understand this, maybe you do, in prison you have groups. Everyone has to join a group for protection. The whites have the white Aryan nation, the blacks have the Muslims and just black groups, the Crips and the Bloods. The Mexicans have the Mexican Mafia, and it's very, very segregated. You don't cross lines. So I decided that I was going to cross lines and just start knocking the crap out of people. I'd go to the head of the Crips and the Bloods. I'd just smack them. They knew what I could do because I broke someone's leg that approached me when I first went in. I was trained very well by the government. So they pretty well tried to stay clear of me. However, when I made my statement and started going around to all these guys, causing trouble with them, they went to the guards and they said, this Tatum guy, he's trouble. We're going to take him out if you guys don't get him out of here. So I was called into the warden's office. A member of the National Security Agency was there. A member of the Bureau of Prisons regional office was there. And they told me, they said, Tatum, there's a threat on your life. You have these tapes. We know you have these tapes. it's a matter of national security that you turn those over to us, because the longer you stay in prison doing this kind of stuff, the better chance is that you're not going to live. So you need to turn them over. I said, fellas, let me explain something to you. When I leave here, I'm going to go find the biggest, meanest-looking guy. I'm going to knock the hell out of him again. And your bosses are going to be real unhappy if I die, because if those tapes come out, they'll go to prison. Within 2 weeks, I was out.
I see. Well, now, those tapes are still secured someplace?
Absolutely.
All right, fine. But you're putting out a lot of this material.
A lot of the material, yes.
Okay, fine. You say that several of the other people of this eight group let's call them neutralizers, they are at the present time in prison?
Only two of them are in prison at this point. Mm-hmm. And we're working now for them to come out under the same. Since it worked for me, we figured it'll work for them.
Okay, fine. Now,
they're working at that now.
What about the other five?
They're here. One of them is ready, willing, and able to talk, is doing shows. The others are sitting quietly waiting to go to trial because they have families. They just don't want to get involved. They've started new lives. But they're all out there.
All right, fine. Well, we'll try get in touch with you off the air and see if we can get this other gentleman onto the air, because we need to get this information out. People need to understand. And, of course, you have various types of audiences. I know you did the Peter Ford Show, and Peter Ford is primarily a secular program. So he's reaching a secular audience. I do predominantly Christian programming in the same area, so we might as well get the Christians to hear this story. And as long as we have a voice, we have to get the information out and hope there are enough people out there in America who still have the courage and the integrity to become involved while we still have time. Because if this persists, of course, there's no question at all that America is either going to be destroyed from within or from without. You can't have this degree of corruption at the highest levels of our government and have that government survive indefinitely.
Oh, no. In a democratic situation, it's only your government is only as strong as the conscience of its people.
Right.
So they have to do something. They can't sit aside and allow this to happen, because it's it's a cancer.
Sure. Well, now, basically, of course, are you doing a lot of talk radio? Or
I have been doing a lot of talk radio. The last few weeks, I've taken some time off simply because I needed some time with my family.
Sure.
Having just left prison in April of this year, I hadn't taken that opportunity, and so I'm just now coming back onto the talk radio, sir.
Okay, fine. Are you having a difficulty getting onto programs? Are they people usually coming and finding you and encouraging you to come on?
Trying to find hosts that will have me on is difficult. I started out pretty good, and I have a lot of return invitations, but I'd like to get out to new areas also.
Well, we can perhaps talk off the air some of the thoughts that I would have, because I would operate in perhaps a little different circles than Peter Ford and some of the others. And I'm not they are excellent talk show hosts, and I think that program you did on the Peter Ford Show really had a tremendous impact. Several people talked to me about it, and one lady actually sent me the tape, so I had a pretty good idea, what had actually transpired. Now, as far as the drugs of the present time, do you have any knowledge about how the government is bringing the drugs in at the present time?
Well, it's stated that 70% of the drugs is coming through Mexico.
Right.
I think NAFTA is a good way that's being used, and only choosing so often trucks. However, I do have knowledge that drugs are coming in on our northern borders also. With the technology that we have today, small aircraft are able to fly from Colombia to central or up into the islands, the Bahamas, rest overnight and wait for a weather window, then in one single direct flight go all the way up into Nova Scotia and land. Then they come across to a place called Weyburn, Saskatchewan, Canada. And from Weyburn, they can fly south, and there's actually a ranch in Weyburn that they're based out of. They fly south and into several areas of Montana.
Well, now, is this being done by our government, CIA, or is this just some enterprising Colombians?
It's being done with the cooperation of a senior FBI official who is carries several cards, CIA, DIA, whatever he needs to.
Now, it was about a year ago when there was an article in the San Jose Mercury, and it was talking about how drugs were coming in from Central America, and they were being sent into Los Angeles, and this was part of a program ready to more or less attack the blacks of Los Angeles. And that, of course, was blown up all across the country. And, of course, after a few months, why, suddenly the San Jose Mercury editor says, oh, it was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And, the you know, no truth to it at all. The reporter who did that said, I think it's true, but I've got to keep my job, and they're going to ban me. They're going to send me off someplace to Siberia, but at least I'll have a job. And so you got to, you know, got a wife and family. You got to keep working. And so, but I'm not going to back down from what I said in that program. And as I remember, he was talking about the same Felix Rodriguez.
That's right. Rodriguez was enormous in the business and enormously responsible for thousands of tons of cocaine into this country.
Well, now, was he working for or with the CIA?
Mr. Rodriguez was working for the Central Intelligence Agency for George Bush under the auspices as an agent for the CIA, not as an officer, but an agent.
Well, you know, when you talk to a lot of people about this, George Bush is their hero. He was the Republican president. You know, he was pro-life. He, you know, he's a handsome man, and he's got a nice smile and a nice family, and everybody liked Barbara Bush. But I think most people have forgotten that George Bush came out of the occult secret Skull and Bone Society in Yale University, where you find so many of the other elitists who really run things behind the scenes, head of the CIA, member of the board of the Council on Foreign Relations, which really caused an occultic foundation, a member of the Trilateral Commission, whose logo is a circle with three sixes in it. If you have never seen it, it's really quite a shock when somebody points out what it's really about. And, of course, this common occultic background behind so many of the people in key positions, and specifically the man who was the Republican president. And yet, if you look what he did, you know, he said one thing and he did another. And we always remember his famous statement, read my lips, no new taxes. And so you know how you can tell when George Bush is talking is because his lips are moving. And people read his lips, they believed him, but as with so many things, he wasn't telling the truth. But, you know, the fact that he was involved in drugs, that is certainly a very powerful statement. Now,
no matter what else people think about George Bush, let me assure the American public who is listening to this program, no matter what else you think George Bush was, George Bush was a drug trafficker and a murderer.
Now, why do you say he was a murderer?
Because he ordered the assassination of 17 people that I know of.
I see. So, and these were...
Including the Prime Minister of Sweden.
Who was that? Palme?
Palme, that's
right.
Correct.
And when was he eliminated?
1986. It was done through one of our OSG officers out of South Africa.
Okay, because I knew there was some sort of a connection to South Africa there. Basically, why did they want to get rid of him? Was he playing the game?
Well, you put a guy like North in charge of... One thing you have to make sure that you do when you move the amount of arms that you move around the world is you need end-user certificates. These certificates have to be certified by a country stating that the arms came from that country, that they originated, or that they were destined for that country. So you need these certificates in place. Because one of the arms suppliers was Bofors out of Northern Europe, we decided we would go, or North decided that he would approach Prime Minister Palme to provide those certificates. So instead of just feeling him out, he laid the whole plan out. Palme wouldn't have anything to do with it, intended on going to the world courts about it.
No, well, you certainly don't do that. You know, I don't know the world court would do anything, but you certainly can't have somebody who might have a certain amount of respect, a certain amount of prestige, talking about this sort of thing.
And, correct. So they decided...
He had to be terminated. And this is the frightening thing, ladies and gentlemen, out there listening on this. I can give you example after example that I personally know of where our government has been killing people. And if they will do that, what else will they do? Once you lose a moral foundation for the leaders of your government, whether they be Republican or Democrat, then, of course, the future of our society, in fact, the lives of every person within that society, certainly are in danger. Now, you know, as the story unfolds, you know, and you see the things that are happening today, do you think there's an awakening across this country?
Well, I think there absolutely has to be an awakening. I don't know that there is yet. I think every day more people become aware. But and I say that because I'll talk to people in the area, and they'll, you know, housewives, mailmen, and they'll say, aren't you afraid for your life? I mean, these are people who are just normal, everyday people. They don't have any particular awareness, but it tells me that they do know that something is up with our government. When they ask me a simple question like, aren't you afraid for your life talking like this?
Have you ever done the Lou Epton show?
Yes, I did.
All right, fine, because I was on with Lou on Monday night, and he's got a tremendous reach, you know, and I think that program goes into 15 or 17 states, and, you know, he's got a lot of people listening to him. He's a very nice person. But in the course of the conversation, you know, he said, you know who the largest importer of drugs is? And I said, of course, it's the American government. He said, of course it is. And, of course, when he says that, I corroborate what he says, you know, there are probably 50 or 100,000 people out there listening and saying, yeah, you know, I haven't wanted to admit that, but when I hear, you know, two rational people saying that, maybe there's some truth to it.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing about American people, they can know it in their head and they can understand it, but until they feel it in their gut, they just never do anything about it. That's something my wife told me. She said, you know, Chip, until these people feel it in their gut, they're just not going to do anything about it. And I understand what she's saying with that.
Well, of course, that's my job. You've got the story. I've got at least a small voice and magnified many times across America. We'll want to get you, of course, onto our Saturday program, and where we actually send that to 13 stations. We hit the Los Angeles area, which parallels the area that Peter Ford covers, but we are addressing a different audience, primarily Christian audience, and then that program is sent to 12 other stations across America, and it's heard, you know, a lot of people out there listening there. Either listening to the station or they're surfing the dial, and so we'll try to expand your message just as far and wide as we can. Well, ladies and gentlemen out there in the listening audience, remember our number here, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a question for Chip, anything you'd like to ask and been afraid to in the past about the American involvement in drug smuggling from South and Central America into the United States, and the various personalities were involved, and how our government has been doing this. Do you think that they're really doing this, targeting certain racial groups in America? Do you think they're doing it for drugs? Do you think they're doing it to justify increasing the federal power of our government in the name of fighting a war against drugs and allowing them now to check our bank accounts to make sure we're not laundering money and allowing them the search without warrants and things of that sort? What do you think the real objectives are at the present time? Because it certainly has nothing to do with the Contras at the present time. It has nothing to do with financing the anti-communists in Nicaragua.
I believe they're doing it for money. For one thing, money equates to power to these people. I've worked for them for a long time. I think that they are targeting certain groups simply by providing more of this into certain inner city areas than they are in other areas. And by doing that, it's evident. Who are they busting and throwing into these federal prisons and having work in the Unicor system for 12.5 cents an hour? It's these young black bucks on the street corners for crack, and they're giving them enormous amounts of time. Yet the big guy on the street, the man who supplied those to these young fellas, these young dealers, is getting no time.
Right, and of course, I think people only have to look and realize that, you know, one in every two black men is either on parole or is on probation or he's in prison today. I mean, the young black man in America has, in my estimation, been targeted just as exactly as Chip's saying. Can you stay with us into the next hour? We've got Rory on the line, and I'm sure that the lines will begin lighting up.
I'd be happy to.
Okay, fine. So,
for this or other messages from Dr. Stan at Radio Liberty, you can call 1-800-544-8927 or write Radio Liberty at P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California, 95063.